All right. I think we read through the beginning of Perek Tetzayin last week. We started to kind of ask a bunch of questions about the conversation between Shaul and God, Shmuel and God, over the mission to go and anoint a new or another king. Part of that is the dynamic of the relationship between Shmuel and Shaul. So we saw right away that it starts with this sense of hesitation of Shmuel, beginning of Perek Tetzayin. I'll just read those opening psukim because that's what we're going to spend most of our time today, next week. Vayomer Hashem el Shmuel, Ad matay ata mitabel el Shaul v'ani me'astiv mimloch ha'Yisrael. So right away you get the sense of rebuke. How long are you going to mourn over Shaul? I've rejected him. I've regretted or changed my mind, so to speak, Haviyachol. I've rejected him from being king of Israel. Therefore, go and anoint a new king. We assume that that's part of the Navi's mandate. The Navi's mandate is to ensure that there is always a leader of Israel, much as we saw by Moshe. When Moshe was told that his days as leader of Israel was over, the first thing that Moshe said was he turned to the Ribbono Shel Olam and he insisted, Yifkod Elokeinu v'chod l'chol basar ish al ha'eda shlo yeh adat Hashem kitzon asher en lehem mo'eh. God should appoint a leader to succeed them, so they shouldn't have a flock, God's flock, as a flock without a shepherd. There needs to be a leader. So there is a certain expectation on Shmuel's part that if, in fact, as he has articulated or had articulated to Shaul in the previous parak, his tenure as king was over, then it really behooves him to ensure that there is a continuity. These things don't happen overnight, meaning it's not necessarily so that Shaul's kingship would end today and a new king would start tomorrow, but a identifiable transition of successor is certainly something which we would expect. And if it's not going to be Shaul, then it needs, or Shaul's son, then it falls upon the Navi to determine who it should be. And that expectation of Shmuel is right off the bat. Vayomer Hashem el Shmuel, ad matay ata mitabel el Shaul. Why isn't Shmuel going into action? Why isn't he doing this? Because he's mourning for Shaul. He is, the emotional tie to Shaul is very strong, as we talked about last week. And God has to kind of prod him, push him. Get up, do something. It's time to anoint a new king. Male karnecha shemen. V'lech eshlachacha al Yishai bet halachmi, ki re'iti b'banav li melech. Go to Beit Lechem, there amongst, in the house of Yishai, there amongst his sons, I have seen a man worthy of being king.
Why doesn't he identify who it is?
That is a very good question. Why doesn't he identify who it is? That's a question we'll have to come back to. I won't be able to answer it tonight. But I will, b'zot Hashem, try to get to it. Critical part of the conversation.
So where's the dynastic part of kingship fit into this?
Dynastic it's dynastic as long as God doesn't take it away from you. Shaul, the intent by Shaul was that Shaul would have a dynasty and his son would sit on his throne. The moment God says no, that dynasty comes to an end.
When do we learn that
kingships are always dynastically based, but the Navi has to determine the authenticity. That's the primary definition between a melech, a distinction between a melech and a shofet. A shofet is an appointed leader. A melech is an inherited dynasty. But only with the approval of the Navi. Som tesim alecha melech, asher mikerev achecha tesim alecha melech, the choice of king has to be made by God. Choice of dynasty has to be made by God. God will appoint the king. In halachic terms, you need a Navi to anoint the first of a dynasty. You don't need the Navi to anoint the successor and heir to the throne, unless there's a challenge to that throne.
But here there's a change in dynasty.
Correct, and that's why you need a new anointment.
Except you got a son-in-law.
Not yet. Right? Not a son-in-law yet. You have a son.
But they got prophecy.
No. That doesn't. In hindsight, then we can talk about the fact that Shaul did not have to kill David to preserve his own legacy. David was a son-in-law, so there were ways to kind of navigate the malchus peacefully. But Shaul doesn't see it that way. But that's way ahead of us.
The Nochri part.
Way ahead of us.
David had. Many generations back, came from a non-Jewish parent.
Came from a convert. That doesn't mean it. Not.
Isn't that not what a king has to be? Born Jewish.
David is born Jewish.
Yeah. Okay. I'm just thinking back to the young Israel.
David is born. Don't go there. David is born Jewish. The fact that his ancestor is a convert is irrelevant.
Yeah. Okay. Gotcha.
All right. ואני מאסתים ממלוך ישראל מלא קרנך שמן הלך אשלחך יישר בית הלחמי כראיתי בבניו לי מלך. In Pasuk Bet is where we're going to spend most of our time over the next 2 weeks. ויומר שמואל איך אלך ושמע שאול והרגני. Says Shmuel to God, how can I go? Shaul will hear and he'll kill me. ויאמר השם, אגלת בקרתי כך בידך, ואמרת, לזבוח להשם באתי. Okay, take an אגלת בקר, and pretend you're going to bring a sacrifice. Say, if anybody asks, that you're coming to bring an אגלת בקר. וקראת לישי בזבח, you call over ישי as you're bringing this offering, ואנוכי עוד יחד אשר תעשה, and once you're there, I'll already instruct you further. That's all I'm telling you right now. So, of course, that raised the question which we started to explore last week. We kind of raised it at the end of the shiur, which was, what is Shaul asking, and what is... Sorry, I do it again. I will do it. You got to keep me on my toes. What is Shmuel asking, and what is God answer? What it sounds like, and certainly that's how Chazal saw it and then raised the question, is that Shmuel is expressing a fear that what he's being asked to do is essentially treason. He's being asked to make a public statement that this is no longer a legitimate leader of Israel. We're going to appoint another leader of Israel. We're going to create what we would call in the vernacular of political science a coup d'etat. Right? We're going to appoint a new leader.
Because all he could be saying is that when Shaul's reign comes to an end, his dynasty comes to an end and he will be replaced by a new king.
That might be all that he's saying. That certainly might be what God had intended him to be doing. That might be even what he ended up doing. But that's not what he's concerned about. What he's concerned is not about the reality. What he's concerned about is
that they'll perceive it
how Shaul will perceive it. It's Shaul's mindset that is of concern at this point. So everything is about second guessing what's going through the mind of a man who is been told already that his kingdom is challenged. It's not an easy guy to navigate and anticipate, and as we see very quickly, is suffering from paranoia. Although that hasn't happened. Right, but all the symptoms are there, all the pieces are there. Shmuel has every reason to be concerned that Shaul is going to take this on him. Now, once it's done, and Shmuel will take the consequences, I guess. But I guess the concern is, how do you get Shmuel to Beit Lechem? Shema Shaul, Shaul will hear that I am on my way to Beit Lechem. What other purpose would I have for leaving Ramah and going to Beit Lechem except to appoint a successor to Shaul? The Haragani will station his guards outside the city. I won't even get to first base. So God has to give Shmuel some kind of ruse by which to get to Beit Lechem, taking a glatt bakar, pretend you're bringing an offering or a egla rufa or whatever it is, get to the house of Yishai, then we'll take it from there. And the question that we raised at the end of the shiur last week was, is Shmuel's fear legitimate? See, is it founded is one question. Is it legitimate for the Navi to have such a fear? After all, he is the Navi, on the other hand. And those are two different questions, but they're interconnected. Is the fear founded? And if it is it legitimate for the Navi to express a fear of this kind and then to devise a ruse, which is essentially a lie, in order to get around that fear?
And it's weird that he's not trusting Hashem.
And that's the legitimate question. That's the legitimacy question. In other words, he's a Navi. He's talking to God. It's like, where's the element of bitachon? So first of all, if anybody did not get a source page or doesn't have the source page from last week, these are extra copies. So you just take one
and... supporting Shaul and you're finding an excuse not to go.
So that is also a possibility, and we're going to see that momentarily. We're going to look at various options in this configuration. Chazal defined this in terms of some narrow focus, and then the Mefarshim sort of pick up from there.
It also looks like something happened in between. In other words, that Hashem didn't answer him immediately.
So those breaks are not always clear as to what they mean. They can be just simply a change of speaker, right? Shmuel asked the question, God answered, paragraph break. Or they could be an indication of something else there. They're not always easy to interpret, those paragraph breaks. But yeah, that what we call a psik be'emsa pasuk. It's a paragraph break in the middle of a pasuk is what you reflect. So what we saw last week was essentially three positions or three different sources in Chazal that reflect a kind of attitudinal discussion as to whether or not Shmuel had the right to express quote-unquote fear. We saw the Mishnah in Nazir and the opinion of Rav Nehorai, which has to do with another subject altogether, which is that his opinion is that there's a pasuk in the beginning of the story with Chana that indicates that Shmuel was a Nazir, because Chana says of her son, Umora lo yale al rosho, which we translate to mean a razor will not come to his head. There is a second opinion that says that no, it's a reflection of not morah with a hay, but morah with an aleph, meaning fear. Umorah lo yaleh al rosho, he'll never be afraid of man. He will be a person whose characteristic and stature is such that he will never be afraid of flesh and blood, to which Rav Nehorai answered, that can't be the interpretation because we see that he is afraid of flesh and blood, that there is a moment in which he expresses fear, and that's here, and that's a downfall of Shmuel, or a negative strike against Shmuel. That's one possibility. The other two possibilities that we saw with Gemara in Psachim and Yevamah, sources 4 and 5, in which the Gemara has a concept of mutar l'shanot mifnei darkei shalom, and when it comes to the sake of maintaining peace and shalom bayit, or peace amongst people, that it's permissible to tell an untruth, or even a mitzvah to tell an untruth, or a lie, or a shinui, to modify what we would call a white lie. How do we know this? We learn this from Shmuel, because not only is the fear question legitimate, says this source, but God actually acquiesces to it. He gives him a ruse, which is essentially a lie. And he's not coming there to bring a sacrifice. Even if he brings it, he's coming there to anoint the king. So God gives him this lie, so to speak, and enables him to do so, mandates him to do so. What about the concept of shlicha mitzvah in a nizakin? Those who are engaged in a mitzvah are not harmed in any way, says the Gemara. Hecha d'shchiach hezeka shani. That's true for supernatural or extraordinary circumstances. But normal, natural events that could be fearful or dangerous, those we are legitimate, and we have to do everything in our power to avoid them. So those are the sort of the parameters of this discussion in the Midrashei Chazal, to see Shmuel acting in a manner which sort of the God legitimates, supports. It it's a normal fear. It's a rational fear. It's a rational concern, I should say, and therefore we need to address it in that manner. So says the Gemara Pesach. When we digress into the world of the Mefarshim, and here we're dealing with the classic Mefarshim Radak, Abarbanel, then we see very quickly that the opinions expressed around the table sort of play out in the Mefarshim also. To put the question succinctly, did Shmuel act appropriately when he asked God, how can I go? Shaul will try to kill me. That question, was it legitimate? Was Shmuel's question fair game? So I'll show you two different approaches to that question in the Mefarshim. They really present opposite ends of the spectrum. It's very interesting to see how the Mefarshim kind of divide up in this question. So we'll start with the Radak. You have the source on the page. I'm going to translate as we go through. So if the Mefarshim, I don't have ready available translations, so I just kind of work with it and we'll translate as we go. The centerpiece around which the discussion of the Mefarshim revolve is the Eglat Bakar, God's answer to Shaul. Matzanu, says the Radak, we have found, ki af al pi she'aya maftiach HaKadosh Baruch Hu, hanavi o atzadik, af al pi chen hu nishma milechet b'makom sakana. Says the Radak, first of all, this is not unprecedented. We find other instances in which God says to a Navi or a Tzaddik or some biblical personality, I promise you, you'll be fine. And nonetheless, when the danger comes, it's acceptable for the individual to prepare or to be afraid. Mm-hmm. And the most famous of those examples is
Moshe?
Yeah. Moshe, maybe, but even before Moshe is Yaakov. Yaakov is classic because there it says that he's afraid. And that's where Yaakov is coming back from the house of Lavan. God had promised him, and the Radak spells it out, Kamo shu'inu b'Yaakov avinu, she'ifticho HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'yavro Aram Naraim v'yamar lo shivoticha l'adama azot. When Yaakov was going out to Aram Naraim, God had promised him, I will return you peacefully, b'shalom, to this place. That was his famous dream with a ladder. And even there, in Aram Naraim, gam sham, go back to your land and I will be with you. So you see that even in that place, God promised him that he would come home and he would be fine. And the moment he hears, Kasher Shamaki Esav Balikato, the moment he hears that Esav is coming out to meet him with 400 men, Vayira Yaakov Ma'od Vayitzelo. Yaakov was afraid and distressed. So the Rashi asks the question right there on the spot. How could he be afraid? God promised him. And Rashi answers, God's promise doesn't necessarily assure him he could have done something in the meantime to lose deserving that promise. You can't rely on God's assurance that you still deserve what God has promised you. You have to do whatever is in your power. So says the Radak, just because God says to him to do something doesn't mean that he's necessarily going to see it through safely, and it's legitimate to be afraid. V'chein, another example. David. Let's take David. David himself, right? We are learning about David. Hayan mshach lemelech, api Hashem. This whole story is about the time in which God comes to him through the Navi and says to him, you're going to be the next king of Israel. V'haya boreach mifnei Shaul. And when Shaul started to threaten him, what did David do? He ran. Now, Shaul is throwing spears at him. Why couldn't David just say, I don't have to worry about those spears, because God's promised me I'm going to be king. I can't be king if I'm dead. So I'm just going to stand here and let Shaul throw daggers at me and spears at me because God promised I'm going to be king. It doesn't quite work that way suddenly in the real world. And he was so instructed and supported by Nevi'im, so we see that it was legitimate for him to run and protect himself. And says the Radak, expand the notion, v'gam b'divrei mechamot ha'yuasin tachpulot ha'chariv tiach achar haftachat ha'kel yitbarach k'mo she'sa gidon b'dvar ha'kadima v'alapidim. Says it's all through Tanakh. The Nevi'im, the Shoftim, the kings, whoever it was, God would come to them and say, through the Navi, this battle you will be successful at. And yet they would still take every method known to them and possible to, within the parameters set by God, to apply appropriate protective defensive tactics. Example of a Gideon is very powerful. Remember the story of Gideon? I won't hold you accountable if you remember or not remember. Sefer Shoftim. Story of Gideon was, going to fight against Midian. It was a major army, massive amount of soldiers. Gideon organizes an army 30,000 strong. God comes to him and he says, too many. 30,000 would match the forces of your enemies, almost one-to-one. If you're victorious with a force of 30,000, then you will end up saying, Penyit Ba'erelai, Yisrova Yemu, Yadai, Yadi Atzil. Less people will say, I was victorious, Kochim Ba'atzim Yadi, therefore, whittle it down. So he sends a message, anybody who's afraid of going into battle should go home. 22,000 leave, leaving him with 10,000. Oh, okay, I can go to war with 10,000 against 30,000 Midianites, God says to him, not so fast. 10,000 is still too many. Take him down to the waterfront, we're going to select who you're going to be left with. Whole enterprise of how that selection process takes place, with the water and the knees and the drinking of the water, etc., subject of discussion for Sefer Shoftim. In the end, he's left with 300, says God. With these 300 men, you're going to be victorious over Midian. Even as a very famous story where he's afraid, where he goes into the camp of Midian, and he hears them talking about a dream that they had about how Gideon is going to destroy them, Cherub Gideon. Fine. God says to him, with 300 men, you're going to take out the entire camp of Gideon. What do you think Gideon should do next? Take his 300 men and attack. Because that's what God told him, right? No. He takes his 300 men, and in the cover of darkness, He surrounds the camp of Midian. He hands each one a pitcher and puts inside this pitcher a lit torch, which is now hidden by the pitcher, so it's dark. And he attacks for all sides surrounding the camp of Israel, making noise against the pitchers and breaking the pitchers so that there's a loud noise, louder than the normal noise that an army, than 300 horses would make. And suddenly the torches light up on 300 sides, giving the impression to the Midianites that he's attacking with 300 platoons instead of 300 men. And under that ruse, the Midianites are afraid and they leave. And he's victorious. So you ask, so that's essentially the question that Adak asked. If God said to him, you're going to be victorious, why does he need the ruse? Why does he need the what he calls tachbula? Why does he need the tactics? Just attack. It doesn't work that way. God sets the parameters, and then you have to do whatever is within the realm of your ability to protect yourself and your men.
He's a pretty good captain to figure out that.
Oh, that was Gideon. Gideon was brilliant. They wanted him
so
to be king.
Were you able to rely on the miracle?
So that's where he's going to get to. That's exactly where he's going to get to, the question of Semchan Olenes. That's where he's going to end up. And therefore, he says in the next bullet point, V'chein tziva l'shmuel anavi tachpula afapisha yo lech b'mitzvato. And that's exactly what happened here. Even though he was going with the command of God, God gave him a tachpula. Tachpula is a tactic. So it was a tactic. Mm-hmm. Now the Radak says, okay, so what's the theology behind this? V'yatam, ki af opisha kadosh baruch hu oseh nisim v'niflaot m'yirayav, even though God does great miracles for those who fear him, berov him al minhag ha'olam. Those miracles are usually couched in some kind of context of nature. V'chein al minhag ha'olam, ayalo li'akov, לירם מפני עשיו, ולדוד מפני שאול, ומי המשך מלך בחייו, והיה לו לבקש תחבלה, איך אלך? And therefore, within the context, the garb of nature, it was natural for Yaakov to feel afraid, and therefore have to protect himself and do whatever he could, or for Shmuel to fear, to be afraid of Shaul and protect himself. And if you go to the next paragraph, we says talks about the aglat bakar, and the Chazal learned from this pasuk that it's a mitzvah to lie for the purpose of darkei shalom. Last three lines, Ne'alo, by telling him this, by telling him to take this aglat bakar, Ne'alo, she'ein ra'ui la'adam lalechet b'makom sakana v'lismoch al hanes. Person cannot put himself into danger and say, I'm relying on miracles. Mishim she'ne'amar lo tenasuna t'ashamu l'kechem. It's a biblical prohibition. You shall not test God. Can't say, I'm going to walk in front of a moving train and know God's promised me that I'm going to be king of Israel, says David HaMelech. I'm going to stand in front of this moving train. I know it can't hit me and it can't hurt me because God's promised me I'm going to be king. Can't do that. With God's promises in one domain, in one dimension, you have to act and live your life in accordance with the context of nature. Do whatever you can to protect yourself and your
environment. Because the whole thing is based on human nature. Human
correct.
Nature tells you, I'm not going to stand in front of a moving train, even though God said to me it's
correct.
Okay.
And it's as counterintuitive as that sounds, that's exactly what the Radak says. And he says, therefore Shmuel has every right to be concerned. What he's being asked to do is legally treasonous. And you can't just walk up to Beit Lechem, which is in Shaul's jurisdiction, and think that Shaul doesn't have the right to protect himself and his malchus and to put soldiers there and to take Shaul's life for it.
So it says to me that. Soldiers versus 30,000 soldiers. It makes it look like it's more of a miracle. Like
correct.
Hand is behind
correct. So that's what we call miracles garbed in nature, right? And if he would have gone to 30,000 with 30,000 and been victorious, to whom are they? It's a famous story about the famous Hanukkah song. You know the polemic about the Hanukkah song. Is it Miyam Alel Gvot Hashem or Miyam Alel Gvot Yisrael? Right. To whom do you attribute the victory of the Maccabees or the Israeli army in modern context? Right? Do you attribute it to God? Or do you attribute it to the tactics? And so, within the parameters that the Torah sets, yes, but it's a very complicated conversation. I'll give you another example. There's a prohibition in the Torah for a king of Israel to have too many horses. Right? Lo yabel osusim. We spoke about this at length in the earlier part of Sefer Shmuel. One of the three prohibitions for a king of Israel. What's the basis of that prohibition? Lo yachzir ta'am mitzrayim leman harbot sus. Shouldn't go back to Egypt. Wouldn't even go back to Egypt. It wasn't moving the people back to Egypt. Shouldn't go back to Egypt to enter into an alliance or treaty with Egypt in order to obtain horses. Where were the horses obtained from? Who was the trade? Where was the center of the commerce of horses in those days? Was Egypt. That's how they became a superpower. So if you want to build an army built on chariots and horses, you become dependent upon a political alliance with the main superpower providing horses in those days, namely Egypt. Says the Torah, I don't want you dependent upon Egypt. I don't want you dependent upon foreign power, foreign aid. You need to have an army made up of soldiers, swords, spears, and shields. No horses. And therefore, you can have a horse or two for your own chariot, but you can't have too many. You don't need thousands upon horses. You need 10 horses for your men and for your entourage, but you don't need an army of horses. That's the foundation of it. And what was the primary vehicle or the primary tool of war of the Canaanite nations into the land we were going? No, the Canaanites.
Oh.
The Canaanites were armies for the most part.
Chariots.
Comprised of chariots. The Plishtim are chariots, the Canaanites are chariots, all chariots. So here's the parameters that the Torah sets out. You're going to conquer the land of Israel with foot soldiers against tanks. Against chariots. It's like telling the modern Israel that you have to provide for an entire army to protect your people. You're allowed to have guns, allowed to have automatic weapons, and semi-automatic weapons. You're not allowed to have tanks, and you're not allowed to have planes. Your enemies can have tanks and planes, but you can't. Why? Because if you have a military, what's the expression? Qualitative military edge? What's the technical, whatever?
That's
right? Then, When you're victorious, who do you thank for it? Right? You thank the United States, whoever supports it, instead of thanking the Rabbanu Shlom, says the Torah. It doesn't work that way. Now, you go and rationally present that as a political platform to the people of Israel.
Then there's a different byproduct too, Rabbi, which is if God puts you, says you're going to have to fight with one hand behind your back,
mm-hmm.
you now have to be pretty clever
to figure out how to do it.
Right?
True.
Out how to now win, or with David, he's got to use a slingshot. So now you have to be creative.
But in the end, right, you know you're outgunned and you know you're outmatched, and it doesn't make a difference how creative you are, you're more likely to recognize the success of that mission relied mm-hmm. on so many things that could have gone wrong and didn't because Rabbanu Shlom was on your side. Much more so than if you had the qualitative military edge against your enemy. Right? Now, this is not a political statement. I'm just telling you what the Torah mandated for the kings of Israel. How many kings lived by that platform? Okay, David is probably the only one, because by Shlomo Melech, Shlomo built an entire army built around chariots. It was one of the problems. And from that point forward. So, it's a problem. It's a challenge to live by that mandate. Says the Radak, we have parameters by which the Torah sets out for us, but within those parameters, we have to do everything within our power to preserve and protect our people and ourselves. And therefore, Shmuel's concern is legitimate, says the Radak. Part one. Clear? Mm-hmm. All right, having said everything, all of that, now we're going to reverse course. Comes along the Abarbanel and says, and says, that may be good and fine for lesser people. But we're not talking about lesser people. We're talking about Nevi'ei Hashem. And the Nevi'im lived on a different plane. And therefore I expect more from the Nevi'im. Says the Abarbanel. This is a very difficult Abarbanel to read. I share with you in advance certain trepidation I have of the significance and consequence of this Abarbanel, because it's really quite remarkable. Hinei ma she'amar Shmuel ech elech v'shema she'ul v'haragani. Says the Abarbanel, that which Shmuel said, how can I go and Shaul will heal and try to kill me? Haya etzli hitnatzlut bilti amiti. I consider this a excuse, a fabricated excuse. Meaning, that's not really what's bothering Shmuel. Shmuel's making this up. He knows full well that Shaul is not going to try to kill him, and that this fear is completely unfounded. And what he really wants is what he really wants is to say no. Sheshmuel lo haya rotze limshoch ish b'chaye Shaul. Shmuel did not want to anoint somebody else in Shaul's lifetime. V'haya beinav ra umar hamaaseh sheyashchit et maaseh yadav hu ba'atzmo. He considered it evil in his eyes that he should be the one to go and have to destroy his own creation. He created Shaul. He was his master. He was his teacher. He anointed him. He raised him. He guided him for years. And that he should go b'malo yadayim with his own hands, and that he should go and totally uproot and destroy that which he created, he couldn't do. He couldn't bring himself to do it. He couldn't do it. V'shu yisakel et yadav, and he should weaken his hands. V'lachen, in order to wiggle his way out of having to go, he made up an excuse and he said, oh, if I go, Shaul's going to try to kill me. Kind of reminds us in a different way of Yonah, who didn't want to go to the mission at hand. And in Yonah's case, he had a different approach to wiggle out of it, right? Because he was being sent to Nineveh. So he went, instead of going north, he went somewhere else, right? Went west. Went, got into a boat and went to Tarshish. Thought that he could get away from God that way. Shmuel knows he's not going to get away from God and he's not going to run away. But he had a different approach. He says, you're sending me on a mission that's suicide because Shaul would kill me. What does he expect God to do? Say, okay, so don't go. He knows that God is not going to let his people, his chosen people, his Navi be killed. He knows that that's not going to happen. He also knows, says the Abavanel, that this, that Shaul is not going to lay his hands on Shmuel Navi Hashem. He's not going to do it.
Then wouldn't he also know that Hashem's not going to change his mind if you ask him to do something?
So it's his way of saying no, thank you. It's an excuse. He knows it's not a real excuse. He knows that it's not true. He knows that Shul's not going to kill him. He knows God knows that he's not going to kill him. It's his way of saying thank you very much, but no thank you.
And Hashem has changed his mind before.
True, but we'll see. V'hu ohev l'Shmuel mo'od. It's a very interesting observation. Says Yibar Bina, how does Shaul know how does Shmuel know that Shaul is not going to kill him? Because of everything we said about how much Shmuel loved Shaul, reverse it. You have to assume that Shaul had equal affection and affinity for Shmuel, who was his teacher and master and he gave him more cover than he gave to his own father. I'm not sure how the Barbanella makes that assumption, because we don't have much conversation about Shaul and his father, but it certainly, right, Yira and Kavod are what we give our parents and what we give our Rebbeim and our teachers, and that's certainly what he gave to Shmuel. It was nothing more than an excuse not to go. Okay? So then ask the question in reverse, if that's the case, then why does God say to him, take an eglat bakar and go? That's why God said to him to take an eglat bakar. Vaya atshuva Mimin ha-she'ela le-faiso b'dvarim. It was a way of appeasing Shmuel. It was a way of, like, Kaviyachol stroking Shmuel and saying, I know. Are you afraid? Okay, so take an eglat bakar. It's not really, you're not really afraid, and you're not, right? So take an eglat bakar. Now, what's the next excuse? Right? Meaning, Shmuel, you're going to go. Don't give me excuses. You're going to go. You want to give me an excuse, I'll give you an answer to the excuse. Okay? But you're going to go. And he doesn't rebuke him for it, which is interesting, we'll see that in a moment, but he gives it nicely and calmly and quietly. He tries to appease him. To stroke him. I know it's hard for you. I know you really don't want to do it. Take an eglat bakar, pretend you're doing something else. I know you really don't want, but you don't have a choice. Not every time is the mission of the Navi to the Navi's satisfaction. Sometimes you have to do things you don't like to do. And that's also part of the mission of the Navi. About Yirmiyahu's mission was much, much more dangerous than anything Shmuel ever did. Yirmiyahu really was guilty in the legal sense of treason. Stood in the presence of the king in the courtyard of the Beit HaMikdash and said, Kishiloya Bait Azed, this house of the Beit HaMikdash is going to be destroyed like Shiloh was destroyed in the eyes of the king. That's treason. He was tried for treason for it. He was thrown into jail, thrown into the pit, and treated like a prisoner of, like a political prisoner for it. And he almost died in the pit for it. And God comes to him in the very first message to Yirmiyahu, in the opening chapter of Yirmiyahu, and he says to Yirmiyahu, Lo tira mehem, don't be afraid of them and don't tremble. You don't have a choice. This is the mission you're being sent on. Option two. Now I could throw out the question to which of these two approaches.
I was going to say, do we get to choose one?
I was going to say. Right? So which of these two resonates with us or resonates with the text? Which is closer to the text? Which is closer to the pshat? That's an interesting question. Comments, questions before I move on to number three.
We talked last week about the Agar Rufa, right?
Right.
Someone dies.
Right.
Right in the field.
Mm-hmm.
So, is that what this is?
That's right? The ruse, meaning the but, assuming that this is the case.
But no one's dead.
Correct. That's why it's a ruse.
But
it's to get you to Beit Lechem.
But everybody knows that when you do the
no. When he comes, when the Navi comes, that's why it says that they came by Yavob et Lechem vecherdu ziknei ha'ili krato. The elders of the city came out to meet him trembling.
They said he was dead.
Right? And they said, Vayomer Shalom Boecha, are you coming in peace? Meaning a Navi comes to the city with an Eglat Bakar, you assume it's an Eglat Rufa and somebody has died. So who's died? Everybody's worried. It's the ruse to get him into Beit Lechem. Once you're in Beit Lechem, the doors are shut, you walk into the house of Yishai, and then you're fine. It's the ruse to get him past Shaul's guards to get to Beit Lechem. That's why when he gets there, he says, no, I've come in peace, I've just brought an offering to bring as a korban. Okay. Now I need Yishai to help me.
Why not have just brought a regular korban in the first place?
So, partially because on what basis would you be heading to Beit Lechem to bring a korban when the Mishkan and the Mizbeach is sitting in Nov or in Gilgal?
But that's what he does anyway, so you have to answer the question.
No, but he once he gets into the city, then he can do what he wants. But he's the excuse to take an animal anywhere else is the classic example of an animal outside of the Mizbeach or the Mishkan is an Eglah Rufa. So, once he gets into the city, he can do what he wants. But getting there without raising Shaul's suspicions, that says is ostensibly the ruse. Now, just a kind of a postscript says the Abamanel. He quotes in the next paragraph this whole Gemara that we quoted earlier. V'chazal amru she'en tzumchin al anes, v'shemutar l'shanam ipnei shalom. Chazal had a different interpretation. They said, you don't rely on miracles, and you're allowed to lie for the sake of peace. And they prove it from Shmuel, who says you're not allowed to test God. And Shmuel be'emet nityarei mishaul. He was really afraid of Shaul, and Shaul needed some sort of a tachbulah, he needed some sort of a tactic. Says the Ababinel, in the bold print, v'ataro eh, Shelo ayaze haminhag b'nevi'im. This is not the conduct of Nevi'im. It might be true for you and me, but it's not the way Nevi'im acted. Ki tamid ayu pochadim. Tamid ayu pochadim. V'akadosh Baruch Hu yamavtiach. V'lo ayam melamdam tachbulot linetzel. The Nevi'im, every one of them, at the beginning of their Nevu'ah, Yirmiyahu says it clearly, Yechezkel says it clearly, are afraid. And God doesn't come and say to them, okay, I know you're afraid, but we're going to create some sort of a tactic. Yirmiyahu, instead of standing at the Beit HaMikdash and saying that the Beit HaMikdash is going to be destroyed, we'll find some sort of a tactic. We'll get into the Beit HaMikdash. We'll set up a code. We'll set up something else. They'll have to decipher the code. You'll get out in time before they decipher the code. They'll figure out what you said. You'll be gone. No. Kadosh Baruch Hu said to him, don't be afraid of them. Says Shmuel, why should Shmuel be afraid? The truth is in accordance with what I have said. The Rishonim didn't mince their words. When they had an opinion, they expressed it. And if they did not like an opinion expressed by another vantage point, they expressed that too. And there you have two schools of thought. Rabbanel on the one hand, and Adak on the other. Take a vote? Well, we don't need to. There's a third possibility to understand this statement about the Eglat Bakar. Up until now, we've been working off the assumption that this Eglat Bakar is a kind of a, is nothing more than a tactic. It's a tactic. Either it's a tactic to address a real concern that Shmuel has articulated, Radak, or it's a tactic which everybody knows is not really effective and really unnecessary, but God is appeasing Shmuel, going along with it. Okay, Shmuel, you want to be afraid, I'll go along with it. But know that you're going to go on this mission regardless. So either it's a legitimate tactic or it's an appeasement tactic to Shmuel, but either way, it's nothing more than a ruse or a tactic. The Radak offers a third possibility of how to understand this Eglat Bakar, which takes us in a different direction altogether. In source 8. So, it's the same Radak. What we shared earlier was opinion number 1, and now the Radak shares an alternative view that's out there amongst the Rishonim. Radak is expressing it. V'yesh mefarshim ki HaKadosh Baruch amar lo kach ani amarti lecha shetelech behatznea. Shmuel, I told you to go quietly, to go modestly, to go to Etlech. Ve'ata amarta shema Shaul v'haragani? And you said to me that you don't want to go because you think that Shaul is going to try to kill you? Ata, now I'm changing my mind. Ani omer lecha shetelech b'fehesya. Now you're no longer going in secret, now you're going to go in public. ותיקח אגלת ביקר לעשות זבחים שלמים ביום משכחה אותו למלך. And you're going to take an אגלת בקר, you're going to make public sacrifices in the public courtyard on the day that you can anoint David in front of the entire, anoint whoever it will be, in front of the entire city. וזה מה שאמרת וקראת לישי לזבח. That's why you're going to call Yishai to the Zevach. אמר לו לך בפהסיה. ונראה מי הורג אותך. And let's see who's going to kill you. Meaning, the whole conversation, or the second half of this conversation, is not God's response to Shmuel as an appeasement tactic, nor as a legitimate tactic, but rather, it's a rebuke to Shmuel. Shmuel, you crossed the line. And because you crossed the line, my response to you is a little harsher than it was. I told you to go to Beit Lechem quietly, still a height, go down to Yishai's house, find you a king, you anoint him, you get in, get out, and be done. Now, you're going to take an Eglat Bakar, and you're going to go, and you're going to make a public ceremony out of it, and all the pomp and ceremony, and we're going to watch and see if Shaul's really going to kill you. How dare you, B'chashim B'chashim? How dare you make that accusation against Shaul HaMelech? He compares it to a precedent. Says the Azad Derech Pirshu Gamkein b'Midrash Mashamar Lo Hakadosh Baruch Hu LeMoshe Rabbeinu Avor Lifnei Ha'am Azeh. The Fish Amar Lo Od Ma'at Uskaluni Amar Lo Hakadosh Baruch Hu Avor Lifnei Ha'am V'Nireh Misokel Otcha. This is an episode in Parshas B'Shalach right after they leave Egypt. People are complaining about water. Moshe turns to God in one of the early rebellions, and Moshe's in a moment of frustration, says to God, what am I going to do to this people, one more time, one more inch and they're going to kill me. God says to him, take your staff, go and find a rock, you're going in Sur and Chorev, you're going to hit the rock and bring forth water. But in the meantime, he says to him, take the staff, va'avor lifnei ha'am. Go walk before the people. Says the Medrash, why do you have to walk before the people? Because it's a subtle rebuke to Moshe that Moshe said, what am I going to do to these people? Od matus kaluni, another inch, they're going to kill me. Mm-hmm. Says God to Moshe, you take your staff and walk before the people and see if they're really going to kill you. Well, you got to learn to understand the people. And you have to learn to be able to separate what's real and what's just a kvetch and what's a legitimate fear. And you need to stand up to them and don't be afraid of them. And they're not really going to kill you. They just say that because they're thirsty and they're hungry and they're tired and they're kvetchy. And that, says the Radak in the second interpretation, is exactly what God says to Shmuel. Shmuel, I'm going to send you quietly, but you're concerned about Shaul killing you? Let's see how Shaul is going to react when you go publicly. And that changes the approach altogether. That may also explain that paragraph break before God's response. Version 1, version 2. Change, not just a change of speech, but change of mission. Changes the whole nature of the mission. Sort of like by Moshe by the burning bush. You know, Moshe engages with God for days upon days upon days, excuses not to go to Paro. Am I that I should go to Paro? What am I going to say to them? They're going to ask me what your name is. What am I going to tell them? What if they don't believe me? What if they don't believe the first oath? What if they don't believe the second oath? What am I going to tell the Paro? I can't speak properly. I don't know the language. I don't know the protocols. Every excuse in the book. And when God answers every one of those excuses, in the end, Moshe responds and says, Bi Adoni, Shlach na biyad tishlach. Which means,
send
whoever you want. Which is really at the core of what Moshe was saying for all week long, just he didn't have the chutzpah to say it until the end, which is, God, I don't want to go. And that's when God responds and says, Vayicha af Hashem b'Moshe. God got angry at Moshe. And he said, Aaron achicha, Halevi, Yetzeli kvetecha, Aaron, the Levi, is coming to greet you, says Rashi. Was the Levi, now he's going to be the Kohen. You were supposed to be the Kohen, and I've demoted you because of the punishment for your chutzpah. In other words, there is an element of rebuke there because you crossed the line. You can argue with God, you can't say no to God. And that's what Moshe did. At that moment, he said no. God says, you can't say no. That's what Shmuel was trying to do. He was trying to say no, says the Radak. God says, you can't say no. That's not legitimate. And it's not fair, and it's not accurate about Shaul. And therefore, you're going to go, and you're going to go publicly, you're going to take a neglect bakar. No longer is it about tactics and ruses and trying to finagle your way into the city. Now it's about walking into the city on God's mission with a big sign that says, I'm here to anoint the next king of Israel, and see what happens. So there you have it. Option A, B, and C. Behind each door, a different interpretation of the story with completely different consequences.
Is the Radak being hypocritical?
Meaning?
Well, he's offered A and he's offered C.
I just offered you A, B, and C.
I know.
Am I being hypocritical?
No.
No, he's offering interpretation A and interpretation B.
Does that not imply that he's not satisfied with one or the other or both of them?
It usually, and this is true more for Rashi than any other, it's harder to see in other Mefarshim because they're less consistent. In Rashi, there's a general principle at play, which is whenever Rashi offers a second interpretation, which usually does with the expression davar acher, dalet aleph, it's usually because there's a strength and a weakness to each. And it's usually textual. Meaning the first interpretation answers certain questions but has certain weaknesses. The second interpretation addresses those weaknesses but has other concerns or weaknesses too. So in Rashi's case, it's usually that's very consistent. It's part of the whole study of Rashi is to try to figure out and navigate what those different interpretations mean. It's much harder to see in other Mefarshim because they're not as consistent. They're not per pasuk. They don't have that kind of methodology so consistently. What is true is that the Radak is quoting, it says, V'yesh Mefarshim, there are those who say it. In other words, this is my interpretation. And there are others whose other interpretation, it's legitimate. It fits within the context of the text. It could be a possible pshat. Whether he buys it or not, probably not. He probably more resonated with the first, because that's what he offers first. But for those unsatisfied with it, he's prepared to offer a second or a third for us. What he doesn't offer is the Abarbanels. In other words, they were not unaware of these other views. They just chose to resonate with some and not with others. More or less, they're all contemporary with each other. Dak is a little bit later, but... So, the Abarbanel is a little bit more... It's not quite radical, but it's certainly a little bit more controversial, because to accuse the Navi of trying to say no for personal reasons is hard to do, but nonetheless, that is the case. Although there's an element to that in the Radak's second interpretation too, right? Shmuel's trying to say no, and God gets angry at him, but he hits the nail on the head. God gets angry at him for it because the Navi can't do that. Whereas in the Abarbanel's worldview, God doesn't get angry at him for it; he appeases him with an altar.
Shmuel dies early, young.
Shmuel does die young, but not connected to this per se. But
not like hitting a rock.
No. Okay. All right, we are going to wrap it up here. I've shared with you, in this context, three different views of the story to date, all based on the assumption that the Seglat Bakar is somehow related to how Shmuel is going to get to Beit Lechem, either in secret or in public, but it's related somehow to the answer of what do I do because Shaul is going to come and attack or try to kill me. Next week, Bezrat Hashem, I will, which is our last class before our break for Yontif, I will share with you a fourth approach, but that we're going to have to develop over the course of this year. So, giving you what I would say is the classic three approaches, and next week we'll add one more to the picture. It's based on a number of sources which we will look at, and then sort of a textual parallel between this story and Parak Tet. You may.